Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
In a few seconds, Sandy Wilde disavowed the work of a lifetime. That's the Wall Street Journal lead this morning about the father of the Wall Street mega merger saying it's time to break up the banks. Here is Wilde yesterday making jaws drop on CNBC.
I think the world changed with the collapse of the real estate market and the housing bubble and what that did because of leverage in certain institutions. So I don't think it's right anymore. Right.
So we'll talk about Sandy Wilde's bombshell now and Treasury Secretary Geithner squirming on Capitol Hill yesterday over his allegedly passive role in the LIBOR scandal. With us is Wall Street Journal economic policy reporter Damian Paletta. Hi, Damian. Thanks for doing this. Welcome to WNYC.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You've been on the LIBOR interest rate fixing scandal, so let's do that first. In 2008, Timothy Geithner, now the Obama Treasury Secretary, was head of the New York office of the Fed under Ben Bernanke when he noticed that something seemed weird about the interest rates that banks were charging each other. What did he notice and what did he do about it?
Well, you know, there's almost more questions than answers at this point, but what we do know is that officials at the New York Fed were notified, you know, quite directly by Barclays, a major British bank, that Barclays and others were sort of distorting the rate that they submit, which is computed into this large benchmark interest rate called the LIBOR. So in other words, they were sort of admitting frankly, to the New York Fed, that this rate was a little bogus, and you know, not much faith should be placed in it.
So go ahead.
And then now we know. Now there's these huge international investigations. Barclays has agreed to pay $450 million for attempting to distort this interest rate. There's a number of other banks, U.S. and foreign, that are under investigation. So the question now is, you know, if regulators knew so much back then, why the heck didn't they do anything about it, and why are we only finding out about this now?
So, for example, here's a question that New Jersey Republican Scott Garrett asked Geithner yesterday.
You had the authority for 4 years to come to us, lay out the problem, and lay out the solutions, and for 4 years you didn't do anything about it.
Ah, but Geithner says he did report the concerns up the regulatory chain when he heard about them in 2008.
We thought those concerns were justified. And we took the initiative to bring those concerns to the attention of the broader U.S. regulatory community, including all the agencies that have responsibility for market manipulation and abuse.
So, Damian, how do we put those things together? He told some regulators, but not Congress?
Well, that's right. And it's clear that they did raise flags. They called the British. They actually sent a detailed memo with recommendations for changes to how this benchmark rate is set to sort of discourage or make it almost impossible for banks to be cheating the system. But they didn't go as far as to call the banks themselves and tell them to knock it off. At least it doesn't seem like they did. And they also didn't tell Congress, didn't make a big public stink about it. And quite frankly, that's a lot of times that's the only way to get banks to change their behaviors, if you shame them in public and get them to stop it. So, you know, clearly they did some things, but maybe in retrospect they didn't go as far as some would have liked. And we have to remember 2008 was a pretty crazy time in this country's history as far as, you know, the banking system goes, and maybe this wasn't their top priority at the time.
Now, what did he mean by this? Here's another 12 seconds or so of Geithner. Is he saying in this clip from his testimony yesterday that they purposely look the other way when the banks underreported their interest rates? Listen.
We were aware of the risk that the way this was designed created not just the incentive for banks to underreport, but gave them the opportunity to underreport,
right.
And that was a problem.
Gave them the opportunity to underreport. Now, I know it's been alleged that, at least in the case of the UK regulators, that people kind of winked at these banks underreporting their rates to kind of give them the opportunity not to raise the red flags about their solvency.
That's right. And one of the main points that Geithner made yesterday was this is sort of a British benchmark rate. It's monitored by the British regulators. British banks primarily are the ones that are involved in this. It's really not, you know, under the U.S.'s jurisdiction. That being said, you know, they did kind of raise a stink about it in private to government officials overseas. But, you know, what we really don't know is how much the U.S. officials told the British that that banks might be actually cheating on this. I mean, it's one thing to say that there's incentives to distort the rate, but it's another thing if they would have called the U.K. officials and said, hey, we know there's some banks that are manipulating this. It's really going to have an impact on borrowers around the world. It needs to stop. The U.K. officials said that they didn't go that far.
It's another nail in the coffin, really, of the credibility of banks and those who regulate banks, right? I mean, interest rates that are supposed to reflect the free market are fabricated so certain banks wouldn't look like they had a problem, which they did, and regulators did not stop them from doing that, and they let the 99%, if you will, be damned, or other one percenters who are also investing depending on these rates, right?
But one of the things that I've really found amazing, you know, the financial crisis, the worst days of it were in 2008 and 2009. It feels to me like there's more banking scandals now than there were then. You know, I mean, it's just like every day there's a new story about mortgage rates or something that banks are being caught doing improperly. And you know, a lot of this stuff is, you know, we're talking about 2008 here, so some of this stuff is, you know, is several years old. But the revelations that are coming out now have really not helped the banking industry regain their footing and regain their sort of public their public position. And there's still a lot of anger at the way the banks are acting.
Right. And when there were problems that were this deep and corruption that was this, you know, ingrained in the system, it's going to take 4 years after things come apart for all of it to come out, and probably all of it hasn't come out yet. Of course, if you ever falsified your own financial statements to come up to cover up a financial problem, our friend Damien would be in jail tomorrow. Is anyone being accused of anything criminal here?
Well, the Department of Justice is involved, and you know, even like I said, this is a scandal that some of the worst things might have happened 4 years ago. As soon as the Barclays settlement came out in June, the three top officials were thrown out of the bank. I mean, you know, there still are shoes to drop. There still is pain being felt. The sort of public backlash and the political backlash to some of these things is still pretty intense, and so I think this is a story that we're going to keep kind of watching the impact of for months to come.
Right. So to be determined, they may have lost their jobs, but will they be charged with crimes if they committed crimes? So we will watch and see.
Great question, yeah.
Next topic, Sandy Weill, former chairman of Citigroup. It was his desire, folks, by way of background, in the 1990s for Citibank, a regular commercial bank, to join the go-go world of investment banking. He was highly influential in getting Congress to change the law to allow commercial banks to take those risks, repealing what was the Glass-Steagall Act. Now, 4 years into the financial crisis, he says that era should end. Here is about a minute of Sandy Weill making jaws drop, as I said, on CNBC as he spoke yesterday.
I think what we should probably do is go and split up investment banking from banking, have banks be deposit takers, have banks make commercial loans and real estate loans, have banks do something that's not going to risk the taxpayer dollars, that's not going to be too big to fail. If they want to hedge what they're doing in their investments, let them do it in a way where it can be marked to market so that they're never going to be hit. And let's have a creative investment banking system like we've always had, where the financial industry can again attract the best and the brightest young people like they do in Silicon Valley, like they're doing in engineering, so that we can lead the innovation that's necessary and the entrepreneurship that's necessary. We can't have a world where it's impossible to make a mistake.
Former Citigroup chairman Sandy Weill on CNBC yesterday. So, Damien, what do you make of this? The father of Wall Street mega mergers now proposing to break up the banks. How come?
This was like watching a unicorn walk down the street. I mean, it was unbelievable. And, you know, like you said, this is a bank, this is a guy that helped pioneer. He had this whole vision of a financial supermarket where people and businesses could come to one place. It was like a Walmart bank. You know, you could get whatever you want, big, small, at the same place. Now he's saying, you know, maybe mom and pop's stores are the right idea, and that's what we need after all. I don't think he has a tremendous amount of credibility on this. You know, him calling for this is not going to – he doesn't have a lot of influence over, you know, people's decisions. But it does – it is another nail in the coffin of this kind of vision, you know, in the late 1990s of a, you know, a different banking system in the U.S. where bigger is better. And, you know, that's sort of the wave of the future. I mean, it's hard to put the genie back in the bottle here. We still have, you know, several giant banks in this country that kind of dominate and really can control a lot of what happens in Wall Street and that sort of thing. And it's hard to dismantle that, especially because there's so many global banks that are really large. And, you know, these U.S. banks feel like they have to compete with them. But it's really hard to see any, you know, a lot of support for big banks growing at a time when you have the godfather of large banks, you know, sort of stepping back and saying maybe this isn't such a good idea.
Listeners, any reaction to either of the things we're talking about right now with our guest, Wall Street Journal economic policy reporter Damian Poletta, either Timothy Geithner's role in the LIBOR scandal or Sandy Weill saying break up the big banks like his own Citigroup? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Mary in Boonton has a reaction. Hi, Mary, you're on the air.
Oh, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I think Mr. Weill is an enormous financial hypocrite who, now that he has his, said, oops, we made a mistake, we should change things. And that's the extent of my comment.
Thank you very much. Well, hypocrite or someone who learned from experience and is humble? Damien, is there a way to know?
You know, I think what she said summarizes the feelings of lots of people. And you're right. The question is he being a hypocrite or is this a deathbed conversion? You know, I mean, he obviously made a lot of money off this, you know, advancement towards the giant banking system and with all these mergers and stuff like that. But it's hard to tell now, you know, why he said what he said. Maybe he felt like he really had to get this off his chest. I don't know. But I know that there was a lot of eye rolling in Washington and on Wall Street and a lot of anger yesterday. We even saw some directed at Treasury Secretary Geithner at his hearing. He was getting pressed on why the Obama administration doesn't support, you know, kind of a similar change that would, to break up the big banks. And this is something we've heard from, you know, conservative Republicans in Washington and liberal Democrats, you know, this idea that the banks have gotten too big, it's too unwieldy, there's too much taxpayer money at risk, and we need to kind of clamp down and change the system. So it's going to be interesting to see how this debate plays out, you know, especially during the election.
When we continue in a minute, we'll take more people's calls. And I want to ask you how specific Sandy Weill got yesterday in terms of actually how to go about breaking up Citigroup and other big banks and whether he offered to compensate anyone for their losses that he may have helped to cause. So stay with us, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we continue to talk about Sandy Weill, the father of the Wall Street mega mergers, now proposing to break up the big banks like Citigroup, which he used to chair, and the latest in the LIBOR scandal, including Treasury Secretary Geithner getting grilled about his role on Capitol Hill yesterday. Let's go to a caller on LIBOR, Caroline in Manhattan, who I think wants to defend some of those involved. Caroline, hi.
Hi. I wouldn't say that it's a defense of, but just a clarification. The artificially low LIBOR helped a lot of the 99 percenters, too, because a lot of HELOCs, the home equity loans, were pegged off the LIBOR. And I know I benefited from it, and I'm definitely not the 99%. So I just wanted to make that specific point, that this isn't clearly a rich versus poor kind of issue.
Caroline, thank you. Damian, how much would you agree with that? Because on the other hand, we have New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, for example, yesterday, who told us that he's looking into possible losses for the New York State Pension Fund, which would be the, you know, the pension fund that helps ordinary civil servants retire, middle-class folks, because if the rates were lower than they should have been, then they weren't getting the returns on their money.
That's exactly right, and the caller raises a really good point. I mean, actually, folks who have credit card debt or, you know, have adjustable rate mortgages might have actually benefited a little bit from this, you know, this distorted LIBOR over the years. But there are a lot of cities that have filed lawsuits because they feel like they've really gotten screwed. And quite frankly, a lot of these cities are in real tough financial shape right now. So the impact on them might have been pretty severe. So I think it's going to take time for us to kind of find out who the victims were here, because this is a little bit strange how the LIBOR impacts everyone's life. But there's definitely folks on either side of this, and I think it's going to take some time for it all to sort of shake out.
So it's still, no matter who the victims or beneficiaries turned out to be, it was still people at the top of the biggest banks deciding that for their own purposes, they were going to manipulate interest rates and lie about interest rates and cover up what the true interest rates should have been, not thinking about the 99% or even their other competitors in the 1%.
Well, the thing that hasn't completely been resolved yet is how high up in the banks were these decisions made. A lot of the banks are saying these are some rogue traders that were just completely out of control and were gaming the system, and we didn't have the controls in now, but now we do. But as you can see from the Barclays situation, three of their top officials are thrown out on the street a couple days after this big settlement. So there's clearly was some concern, and U.S. regulators believe that some senior officials were involved in some of these decisions. So I think that's something that's going to have to play out.
Damian Pletta, Wall Street Journal economic policy reporter, and David in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Hi, Brian. I had a college professor back in 1999 who sat down and explained to our entire class what was going to happen to this country once we repealed Glass-Steagall. And everything that man said has come to pass. It has been absolute chaos since we got rid of that law. I've been working since 2003. I graduated. My entire decade has been a complete wash. I'm 32 now, and it's just like I'm starting over again because of this whole mess of the economy crashing. And I don't understand why this is so complicated. The laws are on the books. They work. Why can't we just dust off an old copy, put it back in place, and carry on with our lives with actual penalties for people who break the law, like these people?
So, great question. David, there were a few people like his professor in 1999 who were warning what would come of the Glass-Steagall Act repeal. In fact, Sandy Weill reportedly has a portrait of himself in his office with shattered glass and the caption, "Shatterer of Glass-Steagall." So is he going to shatter that picture now?
Yeah, I mean, can you have glass shattered in a shattered glass picture? I don't know. I mean, this has gotten a lot of discussion. It got a lot of discussion during the Dodd-Frank debate over, overhauling Wall Street rules. It's just, and I'm sure that it'll kind of get a lot of debate on the campaign trail as Governor Romney and President Obama talk more about regulation. But it's hard to imagine a scenario where they would cleave banks like J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, kind of cleave them in half. And it's just hard to imagine, especially with this idea of U.S. competitiveness overseas, is it going to be fair to large U.S. banks to put them sort of at a competitive disadvantage with large European banks? I don't know. I mean, maybe fairness with Wall Street isn't something people are particularly concerned about right now. But
they also don't want the U.S. to be uncompetitive. But what was Sandy Weill actually proposing yesterday? Did he go further and lay it out, like how to break up the big banks? Is he talking about reinstituting Glass-Steagall?
My interpretation of what he's said is pretty much a reinstitution of Glass-Steagall. It would be to strip away the investment banking side of these banks. There's the side that makes the mortgage loans and the side that takes your deposits and does business loans. That's the side that has the federal deposit insurance. And he wants to cleave off the part that does, a lot of the investing and a lot of the risk-taking on behalf of customers and also on behalf of the bank. And so that's the part that can get into a lot of trouble when they invest in all sorts of exotic financial instruments that can blow up and kind of bring down the rest of the bank. So he's saying, let's cleave that part off, make a nice, safe, old school bank that has federal deposit insurance, then have the other side kind of run as an investment bank separately. Sounds like, that's kind of a radical idea, but, 20 years ago, that was kind of the status quo.
Jay in Riverdale, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jay.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Good. Well, I think Sandy Weill was actually being very sincere when he made those statements, and I think we'd be well advised to heed them. And I think the U.S. government at this critical juncture has an awful lot of influence to engage in some kind of international agreement to separate the banks the way Sandy Weill suggested they do. I don't think the U.S. bank should be at a competitive disadvantage, but why not make even the level the playing field by engaging in discussions with the U.K. and Germany and the rest of the Western countries, and separate the banks the way they were before, separating the investment bank from the deposit end of the banks?
It's a great question, Jay. And Damian, is it possible? Because the whole industrialized world, except maybe Canada, is suffering from this bubble and burst, bubble and bust. And so is an international agreement possible to have kind of an international regime of Glass-Steagalls?
You know, I highly doubt it, just because if you look at, you know, the large banks in China are giant, and large banks in Japan are really giant. And it would be really hard for the U.S. to go to other countries and try to get support for breaking down banks that really make that in some countries makes up such a large part of the economy, and you know, dismantling them would really have a huge impact. You know, and we heard this a lot during the financial crisis when the U.S. tried to call for major changes. The other countries would say, "Well, you're blaming us, or you're taking out what you guys started on us and our financial system." So I don't know how much credibility the U.S. has right now in this, but clearly, with all the suffering that's going on in Europe right now, they seem to be open to ideas over there. So, you know, maybe there's time for a discussion, but it's hard to see anything in the near term actually getting some traction.
Now, we had the former Prime Minister of Canada, Paul Martin, on the show the other day, and Canada never had a Glass-Steagall law per se, but their banks never joined the you know, the crazy speculation. They didn't have a housing bubble in Canada, so they didn't have a crash or a financial crisis, and now the average household wealth in Canada is greater than that in the United States. So could Canada be a model?
Well, I'll tell you what, Canada is the country that's already sort of been deputized to take the charge on this, you know, reform of the LIBOR situation. So there's a lot of folks that are listening to what the Canadians have to say. Their banking system did remarkably well during the downturn, and I think there's probably a lot of lessons to be learned from how they did. But, you know, it's hard to steer a battleship like this, especially a global one, and so... and you know the way these international meetings go, they meet like once every 6 months over dinner, and it's for 15 minutes, and it's really hard to get some sort of consensus, particularly on something that is this substantive.
George in Brooklyn, you're on the air. Hi, George.
Hi, Brian. Just when I read that Sandy Weill said that, I thought to myself, this is really serious because this guy sees it from the inside, and if he's willing to say what he says, I think he sees that down the road either they change or there's going to be a much more serious crash.
What do you think about that, Damian?
You have to wonder maybe if he sees something on the horizon. I mean, I don't know how active he still is. Obviously, he still has a lot of connections in Wall Street, in the world of finance, but he's not, you know, actively in the day-to-day operations of Citigroup anymore.
Or it might even be his own view of Citigroup. You know, we were researching Sandy Weill for this story this morning and noticed that in 2010, he had already expressed regrets. He didn't quite go as far as he went on CNBC yesterday and say break up the big banks. But remember, when he retired in 2006, Citigroup stock was selling for around $50 a share. And when he made those comments in 2010 expressing regrets, Citigroup was down to like $5 a share, wasn't it? Isn't it only trading in the single digits now?
I think so. And, I mean, there was a point in 2008, 2009 when it was on the brink. I mean, it was – regulators were really worried about it surviving. And, I mean, they've come back, you know, from that point now, but they were really in bad shape. And so maybe he did see that, you know, this model that he put together – you know, almost became a real disaster, and he felt like he was compelled to come forward and kind of admit that. But, you know, it's hard to tell, and like I said, a lot of folks yesterday were saying, you got to be kidding me. This is a guy, I mean, the law was essentially changed because Mr. Weill plowed ahead with this plan to combine, you know, this huge insurance company with his bank, and either the law was going to be changed or, you know, everyone was going to have egg on their face. So he was not apologetic in the way that he ran that company. And now, you know, this statement really, I think, has got a lot of people scratching their heads.
Well, we're just about out of time. But it seems to me that our two topics of conversation today, the LIBOR scandal and Sandy Weill's sort of mea culpa, are related. In Citigroup's case, Congress agreed to weaken the basic banking laws so the rich and powerful could find new ways to play. In the LIBOR case, government looked the other way while the banks covered up the mess that their games had gotten themselves into. So in each case, the banks got to play by their own rules, causing harm to others, while government bowed to their wishes. Is that too pointed a way to look at it?
Probably not. No, I mean it's hard to see a way in both of these scenarios where the banking industry doesn't, you know,
call the shots of government.
Right, and they're brought down another peg, and who thought there was any more pegs for them to be brought down? You know, I mean, the LIBOR scandal is going to be only get worse for the banking industry over months and months. And this idea that now there's a civil war among the titans of Wall Street over, you know, what the size and shape of these large banks should be is just kind of a mess for banks, you know, especially because the only real spokesman they had left was Jamie Dimon, and now he can't really open his mouth because all the messes, all the things that have gone on at his bank. So
at J.P. Morgan.
Yeah, it's really kind of I don't want to say a dark time on Wall Street, but it's kind of a different time on Wall Street, and they really don't seem to have been able to turn the corner from the financial crisis. I mean, obviously the profits are back, but as far as public perception, they really haven't been able to get back on track.
Wall Street Journal economic policy reporter Damian Poletta, thanks for your clarity on this. We really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Take care.